Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
Welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. This is John Murphy. I'm an attorney at law and a retired deputy fire chief with Eastside Fire and Rescue out here in Washington State. Not with me today is Chip Comstock from Ohio, who's an attorney and a chief. Kurt Verone from Rhode Island, who is I think he's still a chief and for sure an attorney. And Brad Pinsky, for sure an attorney and a retired chief. Tonight, we're going to be talking a little bit about discrimination and diversity and harassment. But first, I wanted to give a plug for FDIC this year, 2023, Indianapolis, Indiana, from April 23rd to April 28th, for me anyway. It actually goes to the 29th. But we're all going to be there. The attorneys are going to be talking about legal issues. You're going to be joined with 40 plus thousand of your cohorts and peers and instructors, and also does Women in Fire for the first part of the week. So hopefully that we get a chance to see you there. These are great, great presentations. This is probably one of the best conferences for fire and EMS in the country. And I encourage any of you who have never been there to go, and I encourage all of you who have gone before to go again. And so I am speaking on Tuesday, pre-con in the afternoon, on the power of the written word, talking about fire and EMS documentation, which I think is important as an attorney. And you as a provider or responder, to make sure that you document well all of your actions, because some of the stuff that you do is subject to interpretation and certainly litigation. So hope to see you there in my class especially, but in all the classes, make sure you do have an opportunity to show. So to our topic today is discrimination, diversity, and harassment. And this is sort of a legal primer for fire department leadership, just in the way that what we see in the litigation side is these three events are the most litigated events in our country, in our fire service especially, and even in the private sector. So we don't have a unique hold on discrimination, because it goes in all of the private sector as well as the public sector. And so according to the NFPA, in our fire service, we're a predominantly white male organization. About 9% are Hispanic or Latinos, 7% are Black or African Americans, and a little over 6% now are women. So we're seeing a lot more women in the fire service, and we believe that that's the trends that will be increasing and improving over time. Fire department staff demographics, however, those are the people that work in the front office. There are really no demographic statistics for that. It's generally believed that most of them are women, and but there's no identification of age or religion and sexual orientation, those sorts of things that get your organization in trouble. And certainly we may see or we may not see the number of litigated items dealing with front office staff as opposed to what we see in the fire service. So as I said before, harassment, discrimination, coupled with the lack of inclusion is one of the most litigated issues in fire and EMS services with the most costly payout. So let's answer these questions on your own, of course. How do you define discrimination? How do you define harassment? And do you define separately or together? And then how do you define diversity and inclusion? So those are some questions to ponder maybe at the end of the show. Don't want you to think about it too hard right now while you're listening. But I think those are the important questions as to, you know, again, how do you approach those items in your department if you're the leader or if you're one of the fire officers or the firefighters who are working the front office? You know, how do you define those particular issues? So define discrimination, define harassment, and diversity and inclusion. There are some, believe it or not, constitutional protections preventing harassment. The Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 talks a little bit about sexual harassment by employers against employees as actionable and a recognized cause of action. And then in 1991, there are some amendments to Title VII, and it provides for damages in employment discrimination cases and to clarify the provisions of the 1964 Act related to disparate impact actions. Many of your states have protections in the laws that codified protecting employees in the workplace. My state in Washington has several laws. It also has a human rights commission that if somebody's issue in the fire department has not been investigated or not been alleviated or mitigated, then the employee has the opportunity to go out to the outside to the EEO or in my state, the Human Rights Commission. And as I take a look through various state RCWs and codified laws, there's a number of human rights commissions or similar commissions put together that give the aggrieved employee, some opportunity to get some remedial action against their employer. Harassment is defined as a form of employment discrimination that does violate Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And harassment is severe or pervasive verbal or physical conduct that denigrates, shows hostility to, or aversion towards an individual because of his or her race, color, religion, gender, national origin, age, disability, or a reprisal for participating in the EEO process or reporting a violation of maybe your policy if you got one, and we're going to be talking about that in a minute. The potential for harassment, including sexual harassment, exists in every workplace, and there are increasing claims. I think we're seeing a tide of people just not tolerating that sort of boorish behavior in the organization, and so we're seeing litigation across the country that helps to bring attention to the problem and also help to mitigate those particular problems in the fire service. And again, harassment is costly to the employer and to the employee. Many times, and I hate to say this, but a lot of people who file claims against their organization and receive an award go off and find other opportunities where their whole lives they wanted to be firefighters. And now, because of harassment or discrimination or bullying, those sorts of things, they're not in the workplace anymore, and they're off in doing something else. The harasser can be either a man or a woman, and the target can also be a man or a woman. And then also, there's a term that I would call collateral damage, is that The claimant doesn't have to be the target. The claimant could be a bystander who's in the same room hearing the outrageous conduct or the continuing harassment and be affected by those particular actions from a particular employee in the organization. So collateral damaged individuals can also file a claim against the department. And on many times, and we'll see this in the lawsuits, that sometimes not only is the target filing a lawsuit, the person that's supporting the target is also included in the lawsuit because they've been retaliated against in some form or fashion. Harassment becomes unlawful where enduring the offensive conduct becomes a condition of continued employment, or the conduct is severe or pervasive enough to create a work environment that a reasonable person would consider intimidating, hostile, or abusive. Remember that term, reasonable person. That's one of the standards that we'll take a look at here in a couple minutes, is the reasonable person, the reasonable woman, the reasonable man. It's from your perspective, not from somebody else's perspective, interpreting the impact that this behavior had on you as well. So some examples of harassment are pressure for dates, making offensive remarks about looks, clothing, and body parts, touching, telling sexual jokes, or hanging sexual posters, or having books or magazines in public places or in your crew quarters, using racially derogatory words, phrases, or epithets, and demonstrations of racial or ethnic nature, such as the use of gestures, pictures, or drawings, which would offend a particular racial or ethnic group. Negative comments about an employee's religious beliefs, and then negative stereotypes regarding an employee's birthday or ancestry. And so there's a couple of cases up here in Washington State where ancestry was the basis of litigation that was successfully brought forward in the Washington State courts. And the penalties were significant, and the individual who was the target retained his job. And in a sort of an odd way, the person who was the offender, the person that was creating all this disturbance, got promoted. So I don't know if there's any justice in that or not. I couldn't see it myself. You need to have a policy, and we attorneys are always talking about policy, policy, policy. I know that Brad Pinsky did a class on must-have policies a couple of weeks ago, I think, on one of the fire engineering forums. If you didn't have a chance to hear it in person, you should go to the recording, because he and all of us stressed the need for policy as guidelines to help guide behavior, provide an avenue for relief for the persons that, again, that may be harassed or bullied or discriminated against, and also gives the officers an opportunity to measure those particular standards against the current behavior. And so one of the big issues is, and our common theme here is, that if you don't have a policy in place, how are you going to enforce it? So if you don't have a harassment or discrimination policy, how are you going to enforce a harassment or discrimination actions in your organization? So policy is a must have. Also, the conduct must be unwelcome to the target of the harasser. So unwelcome, the term, means that the employee did not solicit or incite the conduct and regarded it as undesirable. So in a nutshell, what you see in these harassing environments is the verbal conduct, derogatory comments, racial or sexual epithets, the nonverbal, staring, derogatory or suggestive gestures, winking, throwing kisses, shunning, and ostracizing. Visual includes offensive pictures, photos, cartoons, posters, calendars, magazines, or other objects. Physical, where there's actually touching goes on, so unwelcome touching, hugging, kissing, patting, stroking, standing too close, invading my space. And then written, so unwelcome personal letters, notes, or emails, or any other electronic form of harassment. There are other forms of harassment. One is bullying, usually physical and psychological harassment behavior perpetrated against an individual. psychological. Excuse me. This is humiliating or abusive behavior that lowers a person's self-esteem. Racial harassment, the target of the individual because of their race or ethnicity. Religious harassment, verbal, psychological, or physical harassment used against targets because they choose a particular religious belief. Stalking, that's the unauthorized following surveillance of an individual to the extent that the person's privacy is unacceptably intruded upon. Hazing, to persecute, harass, or torture in a deliberate, calculated, planned manner. Many times when you have new recruits or new probationary firefighters, there's a period of hazing, which, you know, is determined to be the rite of passage. And a lot of it was because you got hazed, probably. And now it's your turn to be the hazer. But I think that it's important to understand that there's a limit to the type of hazing that goes on. And when the person, the probationary person said, that's enough, I think you're discriminating against me, then you need to stop. The problem that we have is that probationary employees have the perception that they have no power. And so power is a huge, important mechanism here, because you, as maybe the, you know, the third class or second class firefighter, is the senior person there. You're doing the harassing. The probationary employee has no seniority. And so they become a victim. And so when they say stop, my advice to you is you better stop. All right. Another one is cyber stalking or electronic harassment. And this is the use of electronic tools such as email or instant messaging or Facebook or any of those sort of electronic things. And many states have laws on the books preventing this sort of cyber stalking. And it's mainly to protect your kids, your children who are in school. A number of suicides across the country because of unrelenting harassment in the cyberspace. And so not only do they get harassed at school or at work, they also get harassed at home on their electronic devices. And so many times we'll take a look at the basis of a lawsuit and how does that affect, you know, people when they're off duty. And it's because they have become, you know, victims of cyber stalking by a member or a group of people in an organization. You do also have non-employees that come into your organization, like service repair people. They need to be sort of under the same scope of your anti-harassment policy, is that they can't come in and just harass your staff and do all the things that I just talked about. Sometimes you don't have a lot of control over them personally, but you certainly do have control over their business practices. And if it's a technician from a computer repair company harassing staff, you probably need to do business with another company. But for sure, you need to report that sort of bad behavior to his employer or her employer, right? So the harassment test is the severe and pervasiveness, right? The level of offensiveness of the unwelcome act or word, the frequency or pervasiveness of the offensive encounters, the total length of time over which the encounters occurred, and finally, the context in which the harassing conduct occurred. So when we have these sort of behaviors going on in your organization, you want to take a look at, you know, how do we correct behavior? And so, as I said earlier, and all my cohort attorneys will attest, is that policy is very, very important, I think, for an organization, in order to basically outline how you believe your employees should act. And so the policy needs to be pretty solid. It needs to be vetted by your attorney to make sure that it says all the right things that it's supposed to say, because your attorney is going to be defending your organization when there's an allegation of harassment or discrimination. And policies need to be updated periodically. You know, the law changes not that often, but case law certainly does. And there's also good examples of, updated case law as you do your research, of course, after this class is over. That take a look at Kurt Verlin's website or blog, Fire Law Blog. There's lots of stuff in there that talks about discrimination and harassment, and see what the trends are around the country, right? Next is the sexual harassment, right? So the EEOC defines sexual harassment as unwelcome verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. So, you know, it's harassment that's been enhanced with a sexual component to it because of the gender. And it doesn't necessarily happen just to women. It also happens to men as well. Sexual harassment becomes wrongful action when submission to such conduct is made a term or condition of employment, when submission to or rejection of such conduct is used as a basis of employment decisions, and then when such conduct unreasonably interferes with the job performance or creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive work environment. There's a case that called Eliason v. Brady. It's a 91 case. It's a landmark sexual harassment case heard in the 9th United States Circuit Court of Appeals. And so Carrie Ellison employed as a revenue agent with the Internal Revenue Service in California. She alleges another employee had been sexually harassing her, thus creating a hostile work environment, and claimed this harassment was in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The important part of this case, which she won, is that the case redefined sexual harassment in the workplace by examining the case more from the victim's perspective rather than the stereotypical ideas of what sexual harassment in the workplace would be. And so we're seeing a lot of case law recently that sort of refers back to Eliason v. Brady and other similar cases to take a look at the reasonable person standard. And who is that? It's the a person who's aggrieved. In this case, it was Kelly Eliason. And, you know, I think the courts rightfully, which I'm not going to disagree with, of course, found in favor of her from her perspective, not some, you know, a male's perspective, like, oh, this is not a big deal. This happens all the time. It's a rite of passage, or, you know, this is sort of our workplace. That, you know, that has gone out the window, I think. And so we need to kind of make sure that we're right up on top of these new cases as it deals with, you know, again, harassment. But a lot of the seminal cases were developed, you know, back years, many years ago. Some of us weren't even in the fire service when this all started. And so we're taking a look at, you know, case law that has application today. Preventing sexual harassment or harassment in general, and again, you know, avoid behavior, avoid joking. And I know that that's probably not a big issue in our fire service because we joke all the time, and prank, that's the other thing. And so we see these sort of behaviors when they become beyond the pale, they become harassing. The target tells you to stop. You need to stop. You need to stop, right? And again, it's respecting a person's indication that your conduct or attention is not welcome. Don't invade another individual's personal space. Don't touch anybody. Clearly, you know, again, that's that sort of tell people to stop. And eventually you're going to have to report it up through the chain of command. And again, I think part of this is our responsibility as leaders in an organization that we need to have good policy in place, first of all. And second of all, we need to be receptive to the fact that people become aggrieved by bullying or boorish behavior in organization, creating a hostile work environment for those who are part of the problem, and hopefully eventually will be part of the solution, right? There's some comments about, you know, the standards that we take a look at, you know, reasonable person, reasonable woman, reasonable man standard. We have to look at it from the perspective of the victim. So we don't want to always protect the aggressor, which we have a tendency to do because it's your old buddy or, you know, somebody you've worked with your entire life, and all of a sudden you get a complaint against that person and you're the person that's been assigned to do the investigation. I think you need to keep, again, an open mind and take a look at it from the perspective of the person who's aggrieved and filing the complaint. There's some interesting commentary that says if the victim does not subjectively find the environment to be hostile, there is no violation. And I think this is sort of a double-edged sword, is that, you know, fear is a powerful motivator. And so sometimes people are afraid to report, or if they say, hey, I heard from, you know, Chief so-and-so that, you know, a firefighter X is harassing you. Is that true? And so we'll see. And even in my personal experience, the person always goes, well, not really. No, I'm not finding it, an abusive relationship, or I'm not finding this as to be an environment that's hostile. There's this good, good old boy give and take sort of stuff. You got to cut through that fog and get to the crux of the matter is that, again, as I said, fear is a powerful motivator. So we need to look beyond, the sort of blah, blah, blah of everything's fine and take a look at everything's not fine. And you're getting reports from other people that this conduct is going on and you as the leader of the organization need to stop it. So I think we go back to what our department responsibilities are. So we need to have a confidential reporting mechanism in place. It needs to be published, and it needs to be trained to everybody from the top to the bottom that we do have confidential reporting. Now, you're probably laughing, saying that we really don't have any confidentiality in the fire service, because there really are no secrets. And so when we say there really are no secrets, I have a tendency to believe that, being in the fire service for 32 years. Everybody knows something about something. And so if there's a harassment complaint and investigation going on, everybody in your department's going to know about it. Our obligation, again, as leaders, or if you're the investigator, is not to say anything to people. That's, the stuff that goes into your office stays in your office. And you could caution those that you are interviewing to determine, the factual basis here is to just say, look, try not to talk to other people about this because I'd like to have people coming in, from their perspective and not a biased perspective on your part. You need to make sure that your complaints are investigated properly and as impartial and confidential as possible. And then your employees in your as outlined in your policy need to cooperate in any sort of investigation. And I wrote an article a couple of months ago about your rights during an investigative process. And I would encourage you to read that because you do have some rights, even though you may not be the alleged abuser. But, you do have certain rights and obligations that the department needs to extend to you during these sort of investigative processes. So take a look at that article. I think it's entitled Your Protected Rights During an Internal Investigation. So and that'll kind of outline, where you need to come from. If you're in a union, you need union representation. Certainly, you don't have the right to attorney in the room. I know I've been bounced out of several interviews with employees, but, needless to say, I think you do have some rights as somebody who may be part of the investigation. Maybe you're part of the problem. And so and then later on down the road, you're getting charged with a violation of policy for harassment or bullying or discrimination and those sorts of things. So just be aware of that. The best thing is don't conduct yourself in that manner. And so you won't have a problem, right? One of the things that I recommend is to consider bringing in an outside investigator, because my cohort attorneys will tell you the same, and many people who have engaged in internal investigations, unless you're highly skilled at it, we don't do a good job. And a lot of it is we have a bias, I think, towards fellow employees, because we may have worked with them for 10 or 15 years, and all of a sudden you're asked to do an internal investigation on a friend of yours. And those are generally, as hard as you try, are not as successful as we like to see. So the encouragement is to take a look at the outside and look for, a lawyer, another fire chief who's done investigations. Sometimes the police have been brought in, especially if there's a theft issue or other actual violence in the organization, whether it's been an assault or sexual assault, those sorts of things. So you need to kind of take a look at your options out there and just don't go internal. But the other is don't not do anything, right? So you want to be able to demonstrate that the department took a positive affirmative action to try to mitigate this problem. And at the end of the day, you know, there was no finding. There was a finding, their discipline, you know, those sorts of things I think are important in creating this sort of, did you do the right thing at the right time for the right reason? So make sure you have all of those mechanisms in place. One of the several of the cases that we've seen have been brought about by individuals who are reporting bad behavior in an organization have been retaliated against. So retaliation, which means that the department has taken adverse action against you as maybe the complainant or the reporter, is illegal, right? So it's a challenge or chargeable event when filing the EEOC or a state human rights complaint that not only were you discriminated against, but you're retaliated against as a result of filing this particular charge against the organization. And some retaliation examples are you get fired by your organization. And that's, we see that case down in Florida several years ago, not going into the detail, but you can take a look at it. And just Google retaliation claims or go look at Kurt's Verone's website and look at retaliation claims. There's a lot of them. So we don't want to conduct ourselves as employers in that manner. Some other examples are relocating a person to a less desirable station, altering work hours and your job description, unnecessarily psychological or fit for duty evaluations. And for a period of time, there's a string of reported mandatory psychological evaluations on employees who may have reported bad behavior or policy violations. And I can tell you from the psychological perspective, as you know, my wife, Dr. Murphy, is a psychologist. She says, what are we looking for? You know, are we looking for a normal, stable person, or you're looking for somebody who violates policy? I mean, you know, the department needs to kind of clearly outline what those psychological evaluations are all about. And I can just tell you that they're probably not going to fly when you're forced to do a psychological evaluation in a fit for duty evaluation or those sorts of things. That is clearly illegal. And there's a number of cases out there that said this is clearly illegal. Hostile conduct from the officer or somebody else in your organization, and then consistently poor job evaluation. So you're doing good, you know, every year. If you do job evaluations and all of a sudden you're tanked and your job performance is horrible, you know, there may be some discipline or a PIP, performance improvement plan that comes down the pike. And so, those activities are clearly retaliation. So so the employer liability, just as a recap, is if there's quid pro quo, which is a Latin term for this for that, harassment by management, the employer is probably strictly liable, right? Under hostile environment analysis, and if there is a policy against sexual harassment and there was a reasonable avenue of complaint that was utilized correctly by both the victim and employer, then there will not be liability unless the employer had actual knowledge and did not correct the behavior. So the standard is known or should have known. So as an employer, you shouldn't be ignorant to the fact of what goes on with your people in your organization. And I'm sure that you hear stuff all the time about behavior of your employees. Your obligation is to go check it out and find out what is going on to prevent these sort of hostile environment claims, discrimination claims. It creates, you know, a safety hazard, I think, in your organization when people don't trust each other anymore. And so we need to make sure as the employer, you know what's going on in your organization. And if you know what's going on in your organization or you hear about it, you need to take some strong action to investigate and to curtail that particular behavior. I think that's important to, one of the things we didn't really talk about was the sort of the, who do you report to? How does this whole reporting mechanism work? And so one of the items that, and I wrote another article about HR, which I, you know, generally like HR, but sometimes, HR is not all that helpful. And so we need to make sure that your HR department is right up to speed as to how you receive complaints, how you process complaints, what do you do with complaints when you receive one, Do you do assign an internal investigator? Do you assign an outside investigator? And again, it's all that sort of what's the process of your organization, generally guided by policy and training. Some HR managers don't get a lot of training. Other HR people are certified through SBHR. I think that's an organization that does HR certification and other similar organizations. So make sure that your HR person has a has good training. And then some large organizations have EEO divisions in there that you can also report to. I always say that HR is generally in place to protect the employer and not so much for the employee. So I think that if you're getting pushback from HR or EEO, the claim's not going anywhere, they're dragging their feet, hoping that you retire or something else happens. Just say, look, this is not working for me. I need to go to the outside and see if you can get some movement in place in order to mitigate your complaint. Make sure that as the employer, again, you have a harassment policy in place and all the things, anti-discrimination, anti-sexual harassment, anti-harassment, those policies. Make sure you have a code of conduct and code of ethics in place. And it's surprising that ethical standards and codes of conduct are generally seen more in military environments than we do in the fire service. Where I go around and teach, and I know my cohort attorneys do the same, we are always encouraged that you have a code of conduct and a code of ethics in place. And many times, because you can't write a policy for everything in the organization. If you knew what went on in another organization, you'd be like shaking your head and saying, geez, we can't have a policy for that, or we didn't even think about that. The code of conduct and the ethical standards or ethical codes can be used as part of the discipline process. So you didn't follow, so off-duty behavior as an example. Some departments, if not more departments, have off-duty behavior policies than before. And so, in the absence of that, and you have a good code of conduct policy in place, you can kind of leverage the code of conduct into a policy of bad behavior off duty, or, selling drugs in your fire station. Do you have a policy about that? Probably not. And so is that a violation of the code of conduct or ethical code? It certainly is. And so let's encourage your organization to get a code of conduct. Education is important. What does bad behavior look like? What does harassing behavior look like? What does hazing behavior look like? What does discrimination look like? And what can you do as the employee, the firefighter, to mitigate that sort of stuff? And a lot of it is, stepping into the fray. Say, I'm observing this conduct. This is not conduct that I want to engage in or have my organization engage in. You're creating an environment for this employee that's less than, conducive to good working relationship. And it's harassing and probably discriminatory, right? So you can say all those things. And I encourage the employees, if they're observing this sort of stuff, to say something. And I encourage the employee who's the target to say, stop. This is, you're harassing me, And so, and then report it if it continues. So don't be afraid to report it. But again, there's a big power shift here in the organization, especially if you're the probie, you don't feel that you have power. And I'm going to tell you right now, you do have power. So take advantage of that. Take advantage of it. Let's talk about a couple of things. So let's kind of wrap this harassment side up. And again, there's laws out there we already talked about. They talk about petty slights and annoyances, isolated incidents, will not rise to the level of illegality. And again, it's in the eye of the beholder. And so you're the reasonable person. Are you offended, right? Are you offended? So some cases or courts have ruled that, one-time events don't rise to the level of severe, pervasive, work-altering conduct. But is it two? Is it three? What is it? So a single event may be like, oh my gosh, catastrophic. But is that enough to create enough evidence, I guess, to bring forward a harassment or discrimination claim in the organization. And that's, again, in your eye as the victim and in the eye of the beholder. And so the severity and frequency is that another standard. So has it been severe and frequent, and it doesn't alter the condition of the workplace, right? And again, we talked about collateral damage to people that may be in the same room. If you're telling an off-color joke to somebody, or has a joke with ethnicity components to it, and the person in the room is of that ethnic grouping, they may be offended, right? So if it's too, you and me telling a joke, and then somebody who's, who may not be, I'm not talking to you, but in the room and listening, they could be offended. And so I think we need to be way more careful about how we conduct ourselves, with our own firefighters, because other people may be collaterally injured as well. And they can file a lawsuit. So be careful of those collateral issues as well. So here's a checkpoint. Here's the checkpoint. So what have you seen or heard on the job? What have you seen or heard on the job? What have you seen or heard that that you questioned but were really unsure based on your own beliefs, your own background, your experiences in the fire service or other workplaces? Does this conduct rise to the level where, you're offended? And even if you're not offended and you're thinking, wow, this is offensive, it's offensive. Right. So we need to tell whoever making those jokes or whoever's conducting themselves in that manner that this is offensive, and I'm offended. Right. And so they'll probably go, I'm just joking, blah, blah, blah. But it's not. It's somebody's being offended. And if you're thinking this is offensive, it's probably offensive. Right. And then what are the accepted behaviors in the fire service that make you uncomfortable? And so I know that, in my 32 years in the fire service, and I started out, and I'm not going to say what year, but in the 70s, leadership was like my way or the highway, right? So you do what you're told. You don't, talk back. You don't give, any corrective or suggestions that may improve and issues in your organization. It was the order, the command and order model that came out of the, the various wars. So, and we've still had some carryover leaders and who adopted that particular leadership style. Today, it's a little bit more give and take. I think modern fire service leaders are more attuned into the legal issues and the psychological issues that go on in your organization. So, these sort of accepted behaviors that, most of us, like us old guys, came in with are pretty much, hopefully they're out the door. But again, some departments still do that my way or the highway command model. And so that's when we have some problems. All right, let's switch gears. We'll talk a little bit about discrimination. So the unjust or prejudicial treatment of different categories of people, especially on the grounds of ethnicity, age, sex, or disability, right? And so, again, we talk about what protected classes are. And I know that that's been a term that's been bantied about quite a bit, is what is a protected class? And so we take a look at race, certainly religious beliefs, national origin, age over 40 under the Age Discrimination Employment Act, gender identity, pregnancy, right? So under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, firefighters who become pregnant are protected classes. Citizenship, familial status, which is family status in your organization, which there may be, your dad's the fire chief, and then you got hired, and then you came up through the ranks, and then you hire your son or your daughter. They come up through the ranks. That's called nepotism. And sometimes there are policies against nepotism. Or if you don't have a policy, generally it's a good idea not to supervise those who are related to you. Veteran status. So there's been some issues that fire departments don't hire veterans because there's a perception that they may have PTSD as a result of their military experience, which is a wrong way to think about veterans. Veterans bring a valuable resource into your organization, and I encourage everyone to hire veterans when you can. If they're qualified, I know, personally speaking, as a veteran, Navy guy myself, you know, we had veterans preference credits. So we got 10% over and above all of the great things we did in our testing process. So we get 10% more based on veterans preferences. And I think they still do that in some parts of the country today. So hire veterans. Don't think about, you know, where they come from. If they do have PTS or other sort of disabilities, you need to be able to manage that. So hire the employee for what they bring to your organization. Disability status, right, under the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think that we need to make sure that when you have a hiring process going on, that you have not only a job description, which is sort of the rosy, this is what you're going to be able to do. You need to have the essential elements of the job. So the essential elements are dragging hose, raising a ladder, carrying people out of a burning building, doing rescues. And you can take a look at the NFPA standard, because there's an excellent set of job descriptors in there or the essential elements of the job that I think you need to bring into your organization and have that a part of your hiring policy or hiring practices, only because it's a good way to not discriminate somebody against somebody who may be perfectly qualified to do the performance parts. The Uniform Services and Employment Reemployment Act, USERRA, that's sort of a, we see cases periodically of veterans, especially those who are in reserve forces being deployed, and then they come back and there's no job for them, or they have to sue to get their jobs back, and they will get their jobs back. So let's not delude ourselves that we're going to let these reserves go away, fight for our country, and then come back and you're not going to have a job for them, because they will have a job. And then genetic information. It's called GINA, G-I-N-A, Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And there's a big hubbub about doing genetic testing on firefighters. And you know, there's been some mixed review as to the legality or illegality. Some of it, because you can trace your ethnic roots, you can determine any sort of medical, long-term medical issues that may occur. I don't want to get into that arena, but I know that some departments have gotten themselves sideways with using genetic material on their hiring decisions, and I don't recommend that you do that, right? Discrimination is also found in what I would classify as power imbalances. So, you know, physical size, age, social status, rank, personal strength, your gender, length of services, and then we talked a little bit about nepotism. So what's the power position that you have in your organization, and does that entitle you to discriminate against people in your organization? Some discrimination types are pregnancy discrimination. We need to make reasonable accommodations, and there's a whole plethora of information on what a reasonable accommodation is for your firefighters who report that they're pregnant. Do they have to, you know, go right out on light duty, or did they go on FMLA or maternity leave or that sort of stuff? Or can they work, you know, through the third trimester? Just a bit of advice on this one. This is a relationship between their physician and not you, right? So let their physician and the employee firefighter make the decision on when they're going to stop working, and then after they have the child, when they're going to come back to work. This is not an employer. This is the employer just needs to create a pathway to say, tell us what your doctor said. Here's our essential elements of the job. This is what we're expecting you to do as a firefighter. Let them have that discussion with the doctor. Stay away from that. That's going to be problematic for you. One of the issues is lactation rooms. I know that there's a couple of cases in the Arizona area where they failed to provide lactation rooms for nursing mothers, firefighters. And so, my understanding is the lactation room issue is found in a section of the ACA, American Care Act, Obamacare, for those of you who so choose to go there. But anyway, lactation rooms are a necessity in the organization. When you have female firefighters with the potential that they may be pregnant, we need to make reasonable accommodations. The next discrimination type is religious discrimination accommodation. And so we need to take a look at clothing, grooming, hair and facial hair, hours of work, prayer time while they're on the job. And some departments make reasonable accommodations to do that. And then day of non-work for religious observations or the ability to allow shift changes. Some religious beliefs say that I can't work on a Friday or a Saturday. I think the organization, if you, you know, will need to make a reasonable accommodation to accommodate that. Not a lot of case law out there on that. There are a few cases they generally find in favor of the employee and not of the employer. And so, you know, get a head start on this. And if you have people that have certain religious preferences and they come to you and identify them, do everything in your power to make an accommodation. Disability discrimination. You know, this is, it seems so obvious that this is, would be like plain understanding of what goes on. But I think a lot of people don't understand what a disability is. And first of all, and second of all, how are you going to accommodate a disability, right? So we need to take a look at this sort of pattern. So do they have a disability, right? Or a history of disability, or a perception that they have a disability? Is there any sort of an accommodation that, you know, you can make in an organization? I think part of this has to do with how much medical information is available to you to make the decision, then have that conversation with the employee, their provider, their healthcare provider, and an attorney to determine what is the best course of action to do a reasonable accommodation. And again, I talk about having a job description and the essential elements. You can find those in the NFPA 1582. And then if you have a union, you want to consult with a union on reasonable accommodation for people coming back or you know, being new members of the organization. This gets clearly illustrated when you have a firefighter who's injured on the job. They lose a limb, they lose eyesight or hearing, they have a head injury, you know? And so, you know, do you reasonably accommodate that sort of injury, which takes a lot of work to figure out, you know, what firefighters can do with a missing limb? We've done a lot in orthotics and limb replacement as far as the mechanical aspect of it goes. You know, if the person loses an eye, so they lose one eye, do we need to make a reasonable accommodation? And I know that some organizations have gone beyond the pale and said, yes, you can become, you know, remain as a member of the organization. There are certain limitations that you have, but even like in my medical practice, when I do DOT medical certifications for under the DOT standard, hearing is one limitation, but it's not exclusionary, and vision is the other limitation, but that's not inclusion or exclusionary either. And so in my state, in Washington State, you can have monocular drivers, one-eyed drivers. And so in the fire services, there's an accommodation for a one-eyed firefighter to drive your apparatus. And that's a huge high-level conversation as to, you know, does he stay in, you know, in the rear seat looking backwards as a firefighter and as an EMT or a rescue guy, or does he have an opportunity to drive the apparatus? That's the decision that you're going to have to make somewhere down the road. So, and then we do talk about ADA, Reasonable Accommodation, Americans with Disabilities Act. So the big topic today is light duty. And so are they on light duty forever? Is it a perpetual permanent light duty position, which I encourage the answer to that would be no. The other part is, do you have to create a light duty position? And some reasonable individuals say, well, if you never had light duty, you don't have to create light duty in an organization. But I think the prevailing wisdom is if you have somebody who's on short-term disability, you know, they had like knee surgery as an example, or a herniated disc and they had surgery, there needs to be a reasonable amount of time that they can, you know, recover and come back to work and be fully productive. So you need to create a light duty position. That's a your decision. I would say yes, but it's not mandatory. So take that under advisement. And the other part is, you know, how do you make the reasonable accommodation for somebody that does come back to work on light duty? You know, are they going to be doing administrative work? Are they doing fire investigation work? Are they going to do fire inspection work? Are there going to be clerical staff? I mean, what's the story here? So those need to be clearly outlined in, again, the return to duty provisions in a policy. And if they're on light duty, what does the light duty provisions entail? And again, if you're in a collective bargaining environment, you know, what's the labor group say about a light duty assignment? Is it overburdening the patient or your firefighter? Is it like demeaning to that person? So, you know, have those conversations, right? Have those conversations. Therapy animals, which brings up an interesting, as in Kansas a few years ago, you know, I didn't see Dorothy or the Wizard of Oz. I was just teaching fire chiefs, and the fire chief came to me and he said, how do you classify a therapy animal? I said, well, you know, it's under the prevailing wisdom and the law is, you know, any animal that somebody identifies as a therapy animal can be, you know, utilized in that capacity. And so the question is, well, can they bring in the work? And I said, well, you know, that's a decision you're going to have to make. But if you take a look at what the airlines are doing, the therapy animals that they're recognizing are dogs that are trained, right? So trained dogs. It's not alligators, it's not peacocks, it's not turkeys, it's not lizards, and those sorts of things. So I think as a department, you need to have that sort of conversation about what constitutes a therapy animal and how can you accommodate, you know, the firefighter having a therapy animal. So that's a whole conversation. I may have to write an article on it because I thought it was kind of interesting even to have that conversation, right? The next discrimination area is age discrimination. So anybody 40 or over, there are public safety exceptions under the FLSA, section 623, subsection J. It says the fire department can refuse to hire or can fire somebody because of age, which is, how do we do that? Pursuant to a good faith plan, it is not meant to evade purposes of the ADEA. So the example of one is Chicago, no person over 38 shall get an initial appointment. Seattle Fire Department has no age limit. So regardless of what age you are, if you're qualified to come in and you get hired, you can be of any age. And then the feds usually have a mandatory retirement age and an entry age. They won't, like for an example, if I wanted to apply to a federal civil service job, I had to be under, like if I wanted to be an FBI agent, which I don't, but I could be. I have to be under the age of 32 and I got to retire at 60 something. I don't know what the age is, but there's limits there, right? So some of it has to do with the pension program. Other has to do with, the ability to do the work. And so they've determined that, you know, 32 is the minimum or maximum age. And so departments have those, some departments have those reasonable standards. So, and I think they may have been challenged, but again, they go back to, again, what's the business necessity rule? Is the business of your organization such that, you know, you can't allow people over 50 or over 40 to come in your organization? And again, you have to take a look at the existing law that is out there on the Age Discrimination Act. So we get to now there's probably a couple more, which I'm not going to touch on tonight, but we talk about now the reporting mechanism. So now that the individual knows that they've been harassed or discriminated against because it's unrelenting and it's changed the work condition, you're the officer, right? You're the battalion chief. You're the captain, the lieutenant. You're in that food chain as far as reporting the or being informed that there's harassment or discrimination going on. So do we keep these as secrets? And so my, you know, the blunt answer is no, these are not secrets. These need to be pushed up the food chain to the chief or the HR director. If you're the reporting, you know, you're the receiver of this information, but you're not the person to go out and say, oh, you know, old Murphy just told me he's being harassed or discriminated against. That's not your job. Your job is to receive the information, right? Receive the information and then pass it up with as much detail as possible. So some of the terms you could say, I appreciate you speaking with me. However, as the company officer, I'm required to disclose whatever you're telling me, but it'll be disclosed to HR or somebody like with a fire chief or depending on how complex your command structure is. But you need to discuss it, right? You can't keep a secret. That's, I think, the bottom line is, don't make any promises. I won't tell anybody. That's a horrible thing to say. You need to disclose because you need to correct the problem. Now, sometimes people are embarrassed, right? I have this issue going on with my firefighter or my lieutenant. I don't know how to resolve it. You're the next in command. You're the, you know, either the captain or the battalion chief. You just need to listen, right? Listen and then say, well, what do you want to do with this, right? Push it back. Say, how do you want me to address this? Because I will. I can, and I'm under, you know, basically policy is the first thing. Under, I find this offensive, and so I'm going to take care of it. But I have to talk to somebody about it. So I'm just not going to do unilateral corrective action against the offending person without letting other people know. Because then I'm going to be charged with harassment or discrimination or use of excessive force or some crazy thing like that. So it's important that we understand that you need to disclose. Where the disclosure is should be outlined in policy. The effects of unresolved complaints, again, are all the horrible things: absenteeism, poor morale, work not getting done, anxiety or depression on the part of the person who's the the target, increased work conflict, quitting, and then eventually litigation. If you don't manage that right on the front end here, so. It's important that we address, again, the known or should have known aspects of your organization and make sure you're jumping right on top of it. And I always say that going back to policy, we usually write policy for like 2% of your population because bad behavior has occurred and we didn't have a policy in place to correct it. So we write a policy. But you're always managing with, you know, up probably 5%. Some of you may have more experience in you on your problem employees that you're constantly dealing with. So make sure that, you know, again, people understand what the rules of the road are in your organization, and policy is a good way to do that. What happens to employees when they don't comply or they don't report, you know, lost wages sometimes. And again, if the court rules in favor of your employee, they get compensatory damages, right? Emotional distress sorts of things. Punitive damages, and so against your organization. Punitive damages are a deterrent, and they're meant to say this should never happen again. Some such case down in California where a probationary firefighter was basically forced to resign wins a $300 million or a $3 million lawsuit. $300 million, that's a lot. So so it's a huge lawsuit, right? And so and the reason that the award was so large, not only was the behavior egregious, but they wanted to send a message to the department that this is behavior that's not acceptable in our society. And so you're going to pay. And so and we see those. There's another one in Cook County, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, where a firefighter, woman firefighter, was harassed for 14 years. I have no idea how she lasted that long, but she wins a huge lawsuit against the department for this sort of unrelenting, uncorrected behavior that goes on in their organization. And it's the message, right? It's the punitive deterrent or damages that you should never do this again. And hopefully it sets the example for other organizations around our country that and other countries as well that, you know, have fire departments, this behavior and conduct is not acceptable in our modern society. So the last part of this is the diversity, inclusion, and retention, and then and now. And so, you know, I've made references to when I came into the fire service in the early 70s, and it was predominantly men, white males, and it was the my way or highway sort of management structure. And I grew up in that environment. So my dad, you know, was pretty a good dad, but, you know, he was like, you know, this is the way we're going to do it, son. And, he couldn't send me down the road, of course, but, there was penalties if I didn't comply with his unwritten house policy. So, and that's changed, right? So your workforce has changed. So languages in your, organization have changed. I know that, when I see patients in my clinics, they're all from all over the world. And so they speak, you know, different dialects. You know, even in the same country, you may have 40 different dialects on a language that, you know, we need interpreters to help, or family members to come in and help with that. The language is a big issue. Cultural differences, right? You have people from all walks of life coming into your organization, different religious beliefs, religious practices, a lot of different custom. You know, even in your, you know, we're in a uniform, but sometimes, you know, we allow jewelry to be worn, or we allow certain hairstyles to be worn, or headdresses to be worn during the working hour. So I think we need to be flexible and recognize the fact that our employees are coming in from different cultures, different backgrounds, different religious belief systems, and those sorts of things. So, you know, some more questions for you is, what did your department look like when you joined? And what does it look like now? What did your community look like when you joined? And what does it look like now? Right? What initiatives were taken to hire people from different backgrounds when you were hired? And then, were they successful? What initiatives are being taken to hire people from different backgrounds now? So is your recruiting policies and practices to get out into the community and gather as many individuals who are qualified and who are interested to come into your organization? And I did a keynote presentation down in South Carolina a couple of years ago, and one of the Black Fire Commissioners came up to me afterwards, and he goes, "Well, it was a great presentation, but you didn't talk about African American firefighters very much." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he goes, "Well," he said, "we're trying to do more with recruiting what our community looks like, right? So when an African-American young man or woman comes walking by or driving by the fire station and they see nothing but white faces in there, you know, that makes them think, do I want to enter into that workforce where, you know, I'm different, right? I'm not the guys that I'm seeing staring back at me, or the women staring back at me from the fire station." So we need to be, you know, a lot more broad in our approach to bringing on more people into your organization. And again, what initiatives were taken to retain people from different backgrounds when you were hired? And then a question is, who has left your department since you were hired? And then, do the people leaving appear to share a protected characteristic? And so, are we kind of weeding out the non-white male members of your organization based on behaviors that, again, are outrageous or conduct unbecoming to try to eliminate certain people in your organization? So take a look at that. And then again, the initiatives taken to retain people and to hire people from your community. So your community is your fire department, right? So a fire department that resembles its community in a demographic makeup is more likely to be able to provide effective service and garner more respect from your citizen group. For example, if your community has a large percentage of residents who speak Spanish, firefighters who also speak the language can better communicate with citizens both during emergencies and non-emergent interactions. And one of the things I like is that even in my elder statesman age, I'm trying to learn Spanish because I see a lot of Spanish-speaking individuals when I wear my medical hat. And we all have interpreters that will come in and help interpret, but it's good to know, and it's good to be able to speak the language to better connect with that person in a clinical setting. And certainly it's better to connect with a person in a community setting that would help you understand what the actual issues are. And again, let's eliminate the belief that diversity and inclusion mean that the department standards must be lower. And so the question is, why would you do that sort of stuff? And then second of all, between the job description and the essential elements of the job, people need to be able to do those, right? And so when you set those standards, and it's not a high exclusionary standard, it's a standard that the reasonable, ordinary person can manage. I think we need to set those standards and eliminate, you know, those sort of bars or barriers to people coming in. I know that years ago, there was a fire chief that hired people, I think, off the streets, and trained them to be firefighters, right? Trained them to be firefighters. And then at the end of the recruiting academy, did all the other testing, right? The physical testing, the written exams, those sorts of things. But he also, he proved the fact that you could bring people in without all of this sort of pre-testing, and have good employees. And I know that, the testing process goes on as the application, it's the review of the application, it's a written exam, it's a physical abilities test, it's the medical, and after they get the letter of hire, then it's the medical, the psychological, the interviews and that sort of stuff. So it's a fairly elaborate process, but let's not create something in that process that bars or creates a barrier for people that are certainly most qualified to come into your organization. Try to eliminate the mindset that colleagues are family. We like to be called a family, but to be honest with you, we don't treat family members the way we treat our employees. So, and I'm probably creating a firestorm here, but we're running a business, right? The fire department is a business, right? We provide service to the community. We get taxpayer money. And we want to be, family oriented in the organization. But the reality is that we're not, and we don't treat each other like family. And so we need to do that in order to, again, create the safe environment, the safety environment, and eliminate a lot of this discrimination, harassing behavior that goes on in your organization. Identify the steps that the department should take so that every community member is comfortable walking into the firehouse, your house, and then consider whether your department is ready to hire and retain its first woman, pregnant woman, religiously observant, firefighter, transgender, LGBTQ, right? So are you prepared to bring those firefighters on board in your organization and create, again, a safe environment for people, regardless of what their belief systems are? I think finally, you need to examine whether you have problem employees, and I always call them problem children, in your organization, and identify who they are. And then I think put special emphasis on training, that you're not, monitoring them all the time because you've got other things to do. But they understand that there's policies that they need to apply. They need to treat their fellow employees with dignity and respect. And if they can't do that, then they, you need to help them go find another job, not in your organization. So I think that that's incumbent on you as the leader of your organization or leadership in your organization, is to identify those problem issues and address them head on. So, and an example is when you have a complaint, and the same person who is the harasser is the person that is getting charged, and that may have happened two or three times, you have a problem, and you need to address that particular problem. And then finally, you got to review your department's policies on discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. And then discuss with your colleagues whether they plainly explain what kind of actions are prohibited, with examples specific to fire and EMS, and then even your non-uniform staff. So you have a big environment to manage. It's hard work, right? So as a leader or a person in a leadership position, it's not all about fighting fires and going on EMS calls. You're dealing with people in your organization, and those could be your fires internally. So internal fires, a friend of mine, when I first got into the leadership and management structure, I said, any words of wisdom for me? And Neil Good, who was from Lacey Fire Department early in the 70s, said, fires go out. People fires never go out. So remember that. So people fires never go out. So we need to prevent those combustible events from occurring. And then the final is, and again, this is a legal issue, the burden of proof on alleged harassment discrimination remains with the plaintiff, which is your firefighter. And so I think you need to have, again, and reinforce the effective policies in your organization, train your personnel to understand what those policies are, have the standard of being nice to people in your organization, and treat each other like they're members of your family. Always remembering that we're in a business. We're in the business of fire prevention and fire safety and EMS response. And so with that, I am signing off. Hope to see you all at FDIC in April. For those of you who are suffering extreme weather in your neck of the woods in Washington state right now, we're burning up, which is sort of unusual on this side of the mountains because it's wetter over here than on the eastern side. But certainly the western states are on fire. And then in the East Coast, I just saw the weather report of, you know, pretty horrific storm. So be safe, be careful, be good, and we'll see you next time.